einen großen Dank an die Veranstalter erstmals. Ich glaube, das hier ist die einleuchtende Weise, mit dieser schwarzen Heften umzugehen. Und gestern hat mich in diesen Eindruck sehr bestätigt. Also ich fand das sehr ergiebig und freue mich auch auf heute. Und dann eine weitere Entschuldigung, dass das Titel meines Vortrags insofern irreleitend ist, als ich nicht in Deutsch, sondern in Englisch sprechen werde. Und das heißt auch, dass der Titel dann jetzt ein anderer ist, steht auf dem Handout. Faustian Intellectualism and the History of Being ist der Titel. According to Donald Davidson's theory of interpretation, as well as Hans-Georg Gadamer's philosophical hermeneutics, we always stand and remain on substantial ground with the object that we try to understand. This insight is a good, if disturbing, point of departure when the subject matter for discussion is Martin Heidegger's Black Notebooks. Of course, Davidson and Gadamer's point is perfectly general and does not only concern philosophical interpretation. Understanding as such, and thus all degrees of critique, presupposes a substantial common ground between us and the object, the other or the text that we try to understand. Donald Davidson articulates this presupposition of a common ground in terms of a principle of charity and emphasizes how charity is not an option, but a condition of possibility. Charity is forced upon us. Whether we like it or not, if we want to understand others, we must count them right in most matters, Davidson says. Gadamer's philosophical hermeneutics also endorses the idea of a common ground in understanding. But more than Davidson, he emphasizes the highly inarticulate or implicit nature of the common ground, and thus its horizontal character. He does so by specifying the common ground in terms of an essentially implicit Einverständnis. In the English translation, Einverständnis is rendered as agreement or consensus, but what is meant is a shared form of presupposed commonality in our grasp of the subject matter of the other's discourse, however vague and inarticulate it may be. This prior relation to the subject matter that we to some degree always share with the other is essentially implicit, that is, guided by historically constituted pre-understandings that we can never make completely reflectively transparent, or regarding which we can at least not achieve certainty that we have made them reflectively transparent. Understanding thus not only presupposes common ground, but also always expresses an essential lack of control. Even our best attempts to redeem our understanding through acts of reflection have the structure of an event. This is a crucial point because so long as we imagine that it's possible to achieve certainty regarding the reflective redemption of our pre-understanding, we may convince ourselves that making sense of the other could, at least in principle, make use of a measure that could be made fully explicit and against which we could judge the content of the other's discourse or the content of the text. Acknowledging that the idea of such a fully explicit measure is a fantasy also amounts to accepting that our understanding is to some degree something that we passively undergo or that happens to us. An effect of history, as Gadamer puts it. This is not a description, or so far this is not a description of how we could or could not choose to understand, but a philosophical reminder of how understanding always happens. An account of the transcendental aspect of hermeneutical finitude, one might say. Now, the most adequate way for us to respond to the nature of understanding is, according to Gadamer, to explicitly allow the others or the text conception of the subject matter, which we have anyway always already to some degree implicitly included in our horizon of understanding, to come to bear upon our conception of the subject matter. The successful exercise of this effort is the actualization of a capacity for hermeneutical dialogue. For some practices of understanding, it is a constitutive part of what they are, to be aimed at refining and developing the capacity for hermeneutical dialogue. Following Gadamer, we may claim this to be the case of the practices of philosophy. The importance of this endeavor makes Gadamer define the essence of the hermeneutics in terms of the convictions that the other could be right. In allowing the other to participate in a shared attempt to articulate the subject matter by exercising the capacity for hermeneutical dialogue, we may discover aspects of our own preconception of the subject matter that were previously unthematically presupposed, but which can now be reflectively refined, revised, or even in some cases rejected. I remind of this conception precisely because Heidegger's notebooks from the 30s and the 40s is an exceptional case where hermeneutical dialogue, in Gadamer's sense, is not an option. Here, interpretation does not aim to put the pre-understanding, our conviction, that Heidegger is wrong at stake. Our understanding in this instance remains unhermeneutical in the strong sense of Gadamer's slogan. It gives up the aspiration to work out an interpretation open to the possibility that Heidegger could be right in his attempt to philosophically justify National Socialism and anti-Semitism. Now, giving up this attempt to engage in a hermeneutical dialogue with the Black Notebooks, the introductory part of my interpretation is instead diagnostic. The motivation for this approach is an attempt to contribute to nuancing the discussion of the fascist aspects of the notebooks. Even if there's no denying that Heidegger represents a limit case, it is important to recognize how Heidegger's Black Notebooks also to some extent represents an extreme species of a broader genus of thought. This recognition can be achieved not only by sociological and historical analysis, but also by placing him in light of a literary interpretation of the forces that came to expression in National Socialism. In the first part, I thus seek to capture select features of Heidegger's Black Notebooks as a limit case representative of the type of thought Thomas Mann investigated towards the end of the war, in particular in his Dr. Faustus, but also in his speeches, and for which I use the term Faustian intellectualism. Taking the problem of a history centered on a notion of breakthrough, Durchbruch, as a clue from the discussion of Mann, the second part of my interpretation is reconstructive. And I mean here reconstructive precisely in the sense that Gadamer means when he distances himself from this, or not distances himself, but separates between the strong sense of a hermeneutical dialogue where you allow the other to be possibly right, and then a conception where you in a sense step back and remain convinced that you are right, or at least that the other is wrong on certain points, and then try to reconstruct how he did come to have the conviction that you have that you are assuming or that you are convinced is wrong. So this is kind of a ersatz or a placeholder for the ideal thing, namely hermeneutical dialogue. The second best option, you might say, is then to reconstruct within this framework how it came to be, how the conviction that you take to be wrong arose. So my interpretation in this part seeks to articulate a central strand in a light of argument that leads to Heidegger to the conception of Seinsgeschichte, the history of being. The reason why a philosophical critical reconstruction of particular this notion is a relevant task to undertake is that Heidegger understands both his affirmation of National Socialism as well as his anti-Semitic interpretations to be grounded in the history of being. So this is the second part of my title, is centered on the history of being. So maybe one more word. The further reason for beginning with this very short account of Gadamer's conception is that it also gives a first indication of that theme. Because what I presented is, in effect, Gadamer's attempt to draw out the philosophical core of the notion of Seinsgeschichte and re-justify it within a new framework. So in Gadamer's conception, he is still, in a sense, concerned with the beginning, with beginning anew, with the Anfang. But the beginning anew is not a revolution that would exceed all revolutions, as it is in the early 30s for Heidegger, or this eschatologically withdrawn, or even in some cases science fiction-like conception of a new beginning. Rather, it is the beginning that is here, with the text or with the other. And correspondingly, for Gadamer, philosophy remains a historical enterprise, not in the sense of a history of being, but in the sense, and there he's also shows himself to have learned from Heidegger, that history is, with a word he uses again and again, unverfügbar, not at our disposition. And this is precisely because of this idea that our understanding, to some degree, remain intransparent. And to the degree that they remain intransparent, they do not necessarily undermine our understanding, but they give our acts of understanding the character of an event or the character of something that over which we lose complete control. So, in that sense, the beginning of my talk is also a way of stating how that the theme that I'm problematizing, even that, has been fruitfully exploited. Now, first part, revisiting Mann's conception of Faustian intellectualism in light of the Black Notebooks. In his speech, Deutschland und die Deutschen, as well in his novel, Dr. Faustus, Thomas Mann sought to understand what it meant to be German in light of the contemporary catastrophe. The novel, which portrays the composer Adrian Leverkühn and his pact with the devil, made in order to overcome internal psychological obstacles that prevent him from fulfilling his creative potential, is, according to Mann's accompanying novel of a novel, Die Entstehung des Dr. Faustus, ultimately a book about the nature of German culture, Schließlich ein Buch über Deutschtum, he writes. With these writings, Mann attempts to capture some of the important and most intellectually fruitful strands of German thought that had at the time come to perverse expression in the terror regime of the Nazis. On Mann's interpretation in Deutschland und die Deutschen, the image of Faust, the lonely thinker and researcher who sells his soul to the devil in order to gain worldly influence, is apt to describe the situation of Germany in light of the war coming to an end. He finds a certain tendency in German culture to express what he calls an abstract and mystical relation to the world, a relation of world bashfulness, Weltscheu, that he elaborates with the following image. Das Verhältnis einen dämonisch angehauchten Professors, ungeschickt und dabei von dem hochmutigen Bewusstsein bestimmt, der Welt an Tiefe überlegen zu sein. It is hard not to recognize this image when reading the Black Notebooks and Heidegger's many rhetorically high-strung claims to esoteric insights throughout these works. I have give one example on the handout on number one, but we've already yesterday heard plenty of examples. Now, Mann traces the tradition of demonic inwardness, Innerlichkeit, or Faustian intellectualism, back to Luther, the most prominent figure in the speech, whom he regards as a cultural founder of immense importance, even if his influence is deeply ambiguous. Luther, what he calls a conservative revolutionary, struggled successfully for a proper conception of an inner spiritual freedom, including the political recognition of this freedom. But this achievement was coupled with a deeply authoritarian conception of politics, a belligerent nationalism, as well as a deep anti-Semitism. Mann also views Luther as representative of a contempt of politics characteristic of the Faustian intellectualism. With its ideal absolute demands for politics, such a prejudiced intellectualism, Mann says, proves its political inadequacy and is bound to be disappointed because politics, on the sketch that Mann gives in one of his speeches, is essentially an intermediate realm that requires an ambiguous disposition to steer between the necessary all too earthly cynical measures, yet without remaining insensitive to ideal ends. Politics, he says, is an art of actualized irony that allows to cope with or manage life mit dem Leben fertig werden, a conception of politics which is unacceptable to the radical strand of inwardness Mann seeks to capture, because in such contentment with the imperfect, this form of thought can only recognize hypocrisy. In reading Heidegger's entries from the early 30s, and before, under, and after his time as a rector, for instance, it is hard not to recognize precisely this genus of thought as described by Mann. Now, in Dr. Faustus, Mann interprets Faustian intellectualism as the expression of a history of philosophy that rejects the categories of bourgeois culture and civilization in favor of an affirmation of the barbaric or the archaic in the sphere of art as well as in the political sphere. In the narrative of the novel, this line of thought is first presented in connection with Adrian's early teacher, Kretschmar, with the really middle name Wiesengrund that connects him to Adorno's thought. In summing up the point of a lecture by Kretschmar, Adrian asserts that barbarism only contradicts culture within the conception of culture that we have inherited. Absent from this traditional scheme of thought, the opposition may not exist or may have to be conceived in a different manner. Throughout the novel, the affirmation of barbarism in art as well as in politics is repeatedly embedded in a history of philosophy that emphasizes the necessity of a breakthrough of the bourgeois humanist epoch. This thought is articulated in the most extreme terms by the devil, more precisely in the part where he takes a Nietzschean shape. He conjures the following scenario to Adrian. This is quote 5 on the handout. Du wirst führen, du wirst der Zukunft den Marsch schlagen. Auf deinen Namen werden die Buben schwören, die dank deiner Tollheit es nicht mehr nötig haben, toll zu sein. Verstehst du? Nicht genug, dass du die lähmenden Schwierigkeiten der Zeit durchbrechen wirst? Die Zeit selber, die Kulturepoche, will sagen, die Epoche der Kultur und ihres Kultus wirst du durchbrechen und dich der Barbarei erdreisten. Dies zweimal ist, weil sie nach der Humanität, nach der erdenklichsten Wurzelbehandlung und bürgerlichen Verfeinerung kommt. Quote end. Must we not place Heidegger's philosophical affirmation of National Socialism in the same intellectual landscape that Mann depicts in this novel of Faustian breakthrough? Compare the following entries from 1934 in the notebooks. This quote 6 and 7. Der Nationalsozialismus ist ein barbarisches Prinzip. Das ist sein Wesentliches und seine mögliche Größe. Die Gefahr ist nicht er selbst, sondern dass er verharmlost wird in einer Predigt des Wahren, Guten und Schönen. Quote end. Quote 7, aber nicht Kultur, das ist ja nur das Gemächte eines Früheren. Das ist ein Feststehendes, seine Werte, die man völlig verwirklicht. Wir müssen aus tieferem Grund über Kultur hinauswachsen, in einen wesentlichen Raum. Kultur ist ein Gebilde, das nichts mehr zu suchen hat im Dasein. Quote end. Now Adrian, the main protagonist and the composer, thus frequently explains his radical principles of composition with radical political metaphors, without, however, and this is an essential point, how himself fully realizing, let alone affirming, the application of these metaphors to the political realm. In a particularly salient passage, Mann depicts Adrian presenting his ideas for a new mode of composition. Mann here uses an adaptation of Arnold Schoenberg's 12-tone technique. And before accounting for the principle and articulating their artistic motivation more specifically, he describes his conception with the following metaphor. This is Adrian in quote 8. Einen Systemherrn brauchten wir, einen Schulmeister des Objektiven und der Organisation, genial genug, das Wiederherstellende, ja das Archaische mit dem Revolutionären zu verbinden. Quote end. His interlocutor and friend, the humanistic narrator of the book Zeitblom, recognizes the danger of the analogy, but is torn between recognizing the artistic, cultural, intellectual potential of Adrian's affirmation of the archaic revolutionary principle, yet frightened by the application to the political realm. And this is quote 9. Was du da sagst, warf ich ein, vor dem archaisch-revolutionären Schulmeister hat etwas sehr Deutsches. Quote end. Adrian counters in the following manner. Es könnte aber außerdem etwas zeitlich Notwendiges ausdrücken, etwas Remedurverheißendes in einer Zeit der zerstörten Konventionen und der Auflösung aller objektiven Verbindlichkeiten, kurzum einer Freiheit, die anfängt, sich als Mehltau auf das Talent zu legen und Züge der Sterilität zu zeigen. Adrian goes on to explain how he thinks of his artistic principles as not denouncing, but rather redefining the notion of freedom. Die Freiheit neigt immer zur dialektischen Umschlag. Sie erkennt sich selbst sehr bald in der Gebundenheit, erfüllt sich in der Unterordnung unter Gesetz, Regel, Zwang, System, erfüllt sich darin, das will sagen, hört nicht darum auf, Freiheit zu sein. Ihrer Meinung nach, lachte ich, so viel sie weiß, aber in Wirklichkeit ist sie doch dann nicht mehr Freiheit, so wenig wie die aus der Revolution geborene Diktatur noch Freiheit ist. Bist du dessen sicher, fragte er. Übrigens ist das ein politisches Lied. In der Kunst jedenfalls verschränken das Subjektive und der Objektive sich bis zur Unterschiedbarkeit. Quote end. The narrator Seinblut finds the political implication of Adrian's radical rhetoric of breakthrough to denounce the category of freedom that arose from the Enlightenment ideals. In Heidegger's period of enthusiasm for the National Socialist Revolution, we find the following entries from the notebook which rejects the Enlightenment ideals of political liberation, precisely voiced in a rhetoric of breakthrough that invokes the dawn of a new age. I won't read the quote, but it's quote 11. Now, and this is the crucial point again, Mann depicts his main protagonist as ignoring the political application of his redefinition. And instead, it is left to the devil in his conversation with Adrian to emphatically affirm the analogy. So Adrian kind of brushes away, says either through arrogance or naivety, but brushes away some, the analogy. And the novel thereby firstly points to a lack of recognition of the danger in applying to politics what may, within the contemplative sphere of art and thinking, be a proper conception of freedom, but within the political sphere threatens the negative, in modern terms subjective, notion of freedom that remains irreducible in a liberal conception of politics. And since, secondly, the novel leaves it open, whether Adrian's conversation with the devil and the pact with the devil is a projection of his own imagination, the question also becomes pertinent as to whether the lack of recognition expresses a more or less reflective repression of the demonic prospects of applying the artistic principles to the political realm, rather than a mere arrogance or naivety. So in the novel, it is within the narrative framework of the novel, it is emphasized that it's open whether it actually took place, the conversation, or whether it's a projection of his distorted imagination that then is documented in this document that the narrator Seidblum finds. And I think this openness then allows for the interpretational ambiguity, whether it is a naivety or arrogance, or whether it is a conscious or a non-conscious repression, or subconscious repression of this demonic prospects of the application of the artistic radicality to the political realm. And precisely this ambiguity and this figure of repression, I will come back to that towards the end in relation to some of the entries from the Black Notebook. Third and finally, the decisive problem of the gap between Adrian and the devil allows man to emphasize the ambiguity, a term that is tellingly often used by Seidblum about Adrian and his art of the Faustian intellectualism. Although this radicalism is politically dangerous, it is also depicted in the novel as being the vehicle for an enormous creative potential, and in Mann's speech the point is repeatedly made that this form of thought has brought forth intellectual works of extraordinary richness and originality in German culture. This ambiguity is also important to keep in mind when recognizing that Mann lets the devil assume the shape and use the rhetoric of Luther, Adorno and Nietzsche consecutively in his conversation with Adrian. Although he shapes their rhetoric as a demonic parody of their thought in order to bring out the potential dangerous political consequences it harbors, the whole premise of his novel is the acknowledgement that this very same radicalism has proved to be of deep artistic and contemplative value. Now, when reading the Black Notebooks, it is tempting to imagine how fragments from the notebooks might have appeared in the mouth of a fourth Heidegger shape of the devil, alongside the shape of Luther, Adorno, and Nietzsche. Mann, who in the Entstehung des Dr. Faustus programmatically remarks, "Ich kenne im Stilistischen eigentlich nur noch die Parodie," might, however, have found Heidegger's rhetoric out of reach of parody in the sense that it's too easy or that it is already itself a parody. It is, after all, an undeniable fact, and we already discussed this yesterday, that Heidegger's rhetoric, at least in a number of passages from the notebooks, already on their own express an unintended self-parody. I give a couple of examples on the handout in number 12, but one of them was already quoted yesterday by Nikolai in relation to this question of style. But more importantly, the fascism of the Black Notebooks is constitutively beyond the scope of what Mann seeks to portray precisely because it collapses the ambiguous tension that is the whole structure of the novel. The ambiguous tension between intellectual radicalism and affirmation of political barbarism that structures Dr. Faustus. When contemplation has become a pure vehicle for fascism, as it is the case in a certain strand of the notebooks, we are confronted with a limit case of Faustian intellectualism. Here comes to the second part, Heidegger's Faustian bargain towards an understanding of the function of Seinsgeschichte in relation to the Black Notebooks. At the core of the Faustian intellectualism that Mann investigates in Dr. Faustus is a philosophy of history centered on the idea of a drastic and comprehensive breakthrough, Durchbruch. In the period where Heidegger wrote the Black Notebooks, he worked within the framework of the history of philosophy termed Seinsgeschichte, which also implied the affirmation of such a breakthrough, even if it in the course of the 30s and 40s gradually receded into an intangible eschatological horizon. Furthermore, his attempt to philosophically justify National Socialism as well as anti-Semitism is grounded in this notion. In the first of the notebooks containing material from 1931 and 32, we find entries that in Nietzsche present Heidegger's conception of the history of being. From other entries, it is clear that Heidegger connects the development of a history of being with an attempt to problematize the category of Seinsverständnis, understanding of being, a notion that is fundamental to being and time. In one entry from 1931, he writes, "Vor allem ist unumgänglich eine zureichende, wenngleich einseitige Klärung des Seins, nicht nur Seinsverständnis." The quote is not on the handout, but Heidegger is calling for this clarification, not only of understanding of being, but of being. Now, in Being and Time, the examination of Dasein's understanding of being is defined as a preliminary way to clarify the phenomenon of being. Heidegger undertakes the task of articulating the understanding of being in its different constitutive aspects in the analytic of Dasein. And here a transversal structure appears. Dasein's understanding of being is irreducibly an understanding of something as something. The something as something structure is with a formulation from the Grundbegriffe der Metaphysik, an essential determination of the structure of world, eine Wesensbestimmung der Weltstruktur. The fundamental role of this structure entails that being and entities are never given in complete separation. Understanding is always of an entity in its being. Being can only be understood as the being of an entity. The something as something structure can be explicitly as well as implicitly present even before it is expressed in assertions, and it is also structures our perception at its most basic level. Being and time can thus be regarded as an astoundingly rich inquiry into the essential aspects that are implicitly or explicitly shaping our Seinsverständnis, our standing of something as something. In Grundbegriffe der Metaphysik from 1929, Heidegger continues his investigation of the structure of understanding something as something. And here he explicitly closes the door on the possibility of conceiving this structure as a derivative structure in perceptual experience. Also in perception, we primordially grasp something as something, even if this structure is not explicitly present until it is, for example, announced, as Heidegger puts it, in assertion. Despite his emphasis on its foundational nature, Heidegger at the same time seeks to excavate the foundation of the something as something structure, addressing the problem of the ontological difference. In the final section of the Grundbegriffe der Metaphysik, Heidegger asks how this difference happens, geschieht. What is the event or occurrence, the primordial structure, Urstruktur, that grounds Seinsverständnis? Heidegger first emphasizes the nature of Seinsverständnis as allowing oneself to be bound by a measure. All understanding of something as something is implicitly oriented towards a measure according to which the entity is understood as that which it is, that what it is. Obligation, Verbindlichkeit, or normativity, as our contemporary philosophical terminology has it, shapes all understanding and rules all entities, Heidegger claims. Now, in a second, further step, Heidegger asserts that the primordial structure in Dasein's understanding of being is a projection, or more precisely, projection of world, Weltentwurf. Not the projection of the world as a separate entity, of course, but projection of the possible horizon of what could count as being an entity, the very measure according to which something might be understood as something. So ist der Entwurf in sich das Geschehen, das Verbindlichkeit als solche entspringen lässt. At the very end of his lecture, from the following semester, Vom Wesen der menschlichen Freiheit, Heidegger repeats this idea, and now designating the projection of world a primordial form of freedom. This is quote 14 on the handout. Vorgängliches Zugestehen von Verbindlichkeit, aber ist ursprüngliches sich binden, Bindung als für sich verbindlich sein lassen, begegnen lassen von Seienden, verhalten zu Seienden in jeder Weise der Offenbarkeit, ist nur möglich, wo Freiheit ist. Freiheit ist die Bedingung der Möglichkeit der Offenbarheit des Seins von Seienden, des Seinsverständnisses. Now one may suspect, and in the notebooks Heidegger himself gave voice to this suspicion, that this conception of the ground of Seinsverständnis, so this conception that he works out in GA 29, 30 and 31, represents a problematic form of idealism, idealismus, he calls it. After all, how could we make sense of the idea that the primordial structure of world, the ultimate horizon of what could possibly count as something, is a projection? In other words, how could the primordial structure of obligation as such, the measure that our understanding of being always already presupposes, be made intelligible as Dasein's projection? The qualification that the projection of world is, strictly speaking, not to be thought as a reflective act of Dasein, but as a happening in Dasein, cannot silence the suspicion that this account of the condition of possibility for understanding something as something expresses a variation of subjective or transcendental idealism. An attempt to lay a foundation, Grundlegung, as Heidegger would in retrospectively self-critically remark, put it in a notebook entry from 1934 or 1935. Because Heidegger presupposes, however, that philosophy ought to give an account of what makes the understanding of something as something possible, because he assumes that, Heidegger continues his pursuit of the question of being further and now develops his conception of Seinsgeschichte, which accounts for the possibility of the understanding of being in terms of a philosophy of history. As Heidegger retrospectively remarks in the notebooks, it is the transition from laying a ground to beginning, Übergang von Grundlegung zu Anfang. That is, from a transcendental to a historical form of philosophy. It is in his lectures from 1932, Der Anfang der Abendländischen Philosophie, that he finally articulates an account of the possibility of Seinsverständnis that, on his view, avoids idealism. In a section entitled Interlude, Zwischenspiel, inserted between his interpretation of Anaximander and Parmenides, Heidegger departs once again from the structure of Seinsverständnis, the understanding of something as something. He goes on to articulate a conception of authenticity that is no longer to be understood as a general structure, an existential of Dasein. Instead, this new conception of authenticity, termed the liberation to the freedom of existence, Befreiung zur Freiheit der Existenz, has a decisive restriction. This is quote 15 on the handout. Nur wenn es das Sein im Seinsverständnis und dessen Herrschaft gehen soll, kann diese Befreiung zur Freiheit geschehen. Quote end. Authenticity is now restricted to philosophy, more precisely to the pursuit of the question of being. Heidegger also emphasizes what he calls the predominance or the hegemony of the understanding of being. Understanding entities is understanding them in light of what we take them to be, and therefore, without the understanding of being, there would also be no entities. Heidegger emphasizes this point in order to make the claim that only when realizing what is at stake in the understanding of being can an inquiry into what grounds us actualize our capacity for authenticity. Decisive for Heidegger, however, is now that we thereby acknowledge our beginning, Anfang, a term that is here introduced in the double sense that it comes to have in the 30s and 40s. As the beginning conceived as the being of entities that is at stake in our everyday understanding of being, and secondly, as the beginning of Western philosophy, which takes the shape of an inquiry into being. Understanding what is at stake in our contemporary everyday understanding, acknowledging the hegemony of being, we realize that the question of being connects us to this seemingly distant beginning. It makes this beginning of direct relevance to us. Als Gewesener wehst und behält uns heutige in sein Wesen, Heidegger writes. In the end, it is this auseinandersetzung with the beginning of Western philosophy that Heidegger wants to emphasize. It takes the form of a repetition of the beginning. When acknowledging what is at stake in the question of being, and when acknowledging how the question was first answered, namely in terms of a substantial account that attempts to ground the understanding of being, an account that Heidegger's own idealism is itself maybe the last variation on. And finally, when comprehending the inadequacy of these substantial account, as he came to acknowledge in the early 30s, we can repeat the beginning anew. In doing so, we acknowledge what is at stake in the question, but insist on asking it more primordially, that is, as a question, where the experience of actualizing the question, not answering the question, is the measure. In a key passage, Heidegger writes, and this is quote 17, Es bleibt wohl zu beachten, es genügt schon, dass nach dem Sein auch nur gefragt wird, damit es gefunden sei. Dieses Erfragen als solches erbringt den wesentlichen Fund. Und das Sein bleibt nur Fund, sofern und solange nach ihm die Frage steht. Das Sein wird erfunden, gedichtet, gebildet. Nur zu lange gibt es das Sein. Gibt es das Sein Sein. At this point, we can articulate a fundamental problem with Heidegger's notion of Seinsgeschichte, a conception which rests on the following line of thought. First, it establishes the foundational nature of the understanding of being. Secondly, it establishes a conception of Western philosophy by claiming that it is the tradition of the inquiry into the ground of understanding of being. Third, it depicts this tradition as shaped by the attempt to answer the question of being in terms of a substantial account. Fourth, it claims that inquiring into the ground of the understanding of being anew in recognition of the problematic substantial accounts of the tradition, this inquiry in itself provides a claim for philosophical authenticity and also has a creative effect. Being is, as Heidegger says in the lecture, made up, poetically created, formed, erfunden, gedichtet, gebildet. And this conception asserts that such a beginning anew is an epochal breakthrough in the strongest possible sense, because it decides what will count as the possible horizon for the being of entities. And there's Heidegger in the lectures emphasizing this. I won't read the quote, but it's quote 18. The problem here is that Heidegger proceeds as if he had an alternative, authoritative account of the possibility of the understanding of being, the possibility of understanding something as something, while in reality all he possesses is an experience of asking that question. Now, of course, the experience of the question of being, the disturbing wonder that entities are disclosed to us as something at all, while lacking any substantial foundation in terms of an account of their origin, can amount to a significant experience. Meine Grunderfahrung, Heidegger calls it in the notebooks. But acknowledging the existence of such a Grunderfahrung is not the same as asserting it as an authoritative account of the understanding of being that Heidegger would need in order to do what he does, shape a history of philosophy. Of course, Heidegger would object that he's precisely not giving an account or articulating a condition of possibility with his Seinsgeschichte. He is, according to his self-conception, pursuing the question of being, articulating the consequences of his Grunderfahrung in an interpretation of what has been thought in response to this question before him. But then, and this is the equivocation, then his history of being cannot presume to have the philosophical authority, because the experience that Heidegger has then becomes a supernorm. And he doesn't establish with arguments that it has this. Not surprisingly, perhaps, but it's still important to see how that he never establishes with arguments that it doesn't have this status. Isn't Heidegger's idea of poetically creating being, that also appears in notebooks and also in the lecture of 32 in these years, a sign of this embarrassment? An attempt to shirk responsibility for acknowledging this fundamental problem by instead creating a master narrative, so exactly the Geschichte in this sense, in which the framing events established in Der Anfang der Philosophie represents only the first broad outline. Heidegger's confusion of his Grunderfahrung with a substantial account of the possibility of the understanding of being, of course, in itself would motivate him to expand upon the first roughly defined elements and create what would become the main protagonist, themes, events, and sites of the history of being. This very development would have helped him to convince himself that he was on the right track, that he was not the subject to confusion in ascribing the authority to the question of being that he did. A flight forward in a logic of repression and self-delusion sets on in Heidegger's work. One of the features of the Black Notebooks, in virtue of their character as philosophical journals, this is Trani's term, Denktagebücher, is that they allow us insight into how Heidegger included his own personal history and actions in this logic. I will end by giving a paradigmatic example of this using a programmatic entry from the end of the 30s where he interprets his affirmation of National Socialism a few years earlier in terms of a mistaken belief that this movement presented an opportunity for a transition in the second beginning. We already discussed this quote yesterday. I will not read it aloud, but it's quote 19 on the handout. But essentially, Heidegger is saying that he was wrong to affirm National Socialism as a transition into beginning anew or into second beginning. But in the very same entry, Heidegger explicitly affirms National Socialism as a necessary historical phenomenon, precisely insofar as it belongs to the completion of the modern age. While this movement does no longer offer the possibility of a transition, but rather expresses the supremacy of entities, Heidegger now regards it as a necessary step towards a beginning anew. The premise for this is that the modern age must be tragically completed in order for the transition to the second beginning, the decision in favor of being to be made. And in the vicinity of this entry, there are some reflections on tragedy. I think it's very telling that Heidegger begins to speak of this in terms of a narrative of tragedy. In the tragedy of the history of being, which Heidegger now stages, the term delusion, Täuschung, plays an important ambiguous role. In the entry, with the former quote, he writes, and this is also on the handout, I think, this must be then 20. Täuschungen, durchdacht und durchlitten in allen ihren Abgründen, sind Wege zu dem, was ist. Heidegger wants to understand delusions in the Aeschylean tradition of pathos mathai as instances of arte that constitute experiences of suffering through which insight may be won. In Heidegger's sense, as the italics and inverted commas emphasize, insight is of course to be understood in the sense of ways to a more adequate relation to being. Yet the sentence is ambiguous. It describes, on the one hand, Heidegger's delusions earlier in the 30s when he took National Socialism to represent a transition in the history of being, as well as his trust in the university as sites of essential reflections, ideas that are now explicitly termed as Täuschung. He uses the same words about what he formerly did. But the ambiguity is that he also uses the word in another way. On the other hand, precisely through these subjective delusions, you might call them, using Hegelian terms, Heidegger now claims to have gained insight into the objective delusion of the modern era, the metaphysical logic of technical rationality. This was the point of reaffirming National Socialism as a tragic necessity. In sum, the entry tries to depict his own philosophical misinterpretation as tragic experiences from which insight has been won by inscribing these delusions into the history of being, which at the same time is interpreted as a greater, encompassing tragedy. And it is this approach that allows him to make sense of his own shifting role as a protagonist within the tragic history of being. From having played the role of a daring hero at the center of the stage and suffered the consequences of his inevitable disillusion, he has now stepped back to become a prophet that interprets the movements of the protagonist in the tragedy of being that he sees unfolding. In both roles he expressed a privileged tragic assignment, according to his own view, Zugewiesenheit. And he defines this on quote 22 on the handout. Das Tragische ist eine ausgezeichnete Zugewiesenheit des jeweils Wesens offenen Menschen in die Wesung des Seins. So this jeweils Wesens offenen Menschen is, again, it collapses with Heidegger, as in much of this rhetoric. He thus employs tragic categories as means of justifying his personal and philosophical experience. Insofar and as long as Heidegger could convince himself of the adequacy of the tragic self-interpretation he puts forward in the notebooks, it would have strengthened his resolve not to relate to his engagement in National Socialism as something for which he had to give an account that invoked moral or ethical choice in any strong sense. After all, he had played his part, and insofar as he had expressed moral fault, the proper response was to interpret this fault as a tragic fault, and thus remain within an aesthetic mode of understanding rather than to address the moral fault as a moral fault. At the same time, the tragic narrative allowed him to avoid undertaking the philosophical responsibility of questioning Seinsgeschichte, the conceptual framework that motivated his early understanding of National Socialism. In fact, the conception of Seinsgeschichte is what allows him to put forward his later self-interpretation and thus could not be questioned. Rather than taking his failure in the beginning of the decade as an opportunity to revise the fundamental presupposition implied in history of philosophy, he interpreted the failure as a delusion from which further insight into the nature of his history of philosophy could be won. The tragic categories thus exonerates Heidegger from accounting for the personal moral and political judgment that motivated his political engagement, and it also permits him an escape from a philosophical crisis of reconsidering the adequacy of the very idea of Seinsgeschichte. As we have seen, the conception of Seinsgeschichte was introduced in order to eradicate what Heidegger himself, rightly I think, took to be an untenable tendency to idealism in his account of the Grund of Seinsverständnis. But he continued to believe that it was demanded to philosophically relate to the problem or the question to which his former account had been an answer, if only by asking the question, that is, the question of being. The authority he continued to ascribe to this question made him construct a narrative that allowed all forms of uncontrolled and unreflected prejudice, entrance and validation as being of philosophical import, because Heidegger was merely forced to relate the given phenomenon to the to his Grunderfahrung, to the experience of the question of being, now understood as the primordial form of authenticity. As long as he could do this, any and all kind of prejudice could demand his attention as philosophical subject matter that either expressed a possible transition towards a second beginning or, more likely, a form of forgetting of being. After the publication of the Black Notebooks, we know that the list of problematic prejudice that Heidegger allowed to invade his philosophy was long. In this light, I may perhaps be allowed a final reference to another classic text on demonic possession. This is Luke chapter 11, verse 24-26, and it's quoted on the handout in the Luther's German translation. I can read in English here. When the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest, and not finding any, it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds it swept and put in order. Then it goes and takes along seven other spirits, more evil than itself, and they go in and live here. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. Thank you.